The title of Alfred McCoy's book says it all, The Politics of Heroin, CIA Complicity in the Global Drug Trade. First written in 1972 and recently revised, this meticulously researched book has become the source on the CIA's involvement in the global drug trade. McCoy says the CIA's complicity in the global drug trade isn't part of some evil design, it's just a matter of priorities.
The CIA during the Cold War found itself trying to contain communism. In Europe, that meant the Berlin Wall and NATO and the Warsaw Pact confrontation. But along the soft underbelly of Asia, across 5,000 miles from Turkey to Thailand, the southern frontier of the Soviet Union, the southern frontier of the People's Republic of China, there was a mountain rim of Asia that went from the Hindu Kush through the Himalayas through the Golden Triangle of Southeast Asia. And along these 5,000 miles of mountains, the CIA found itself mounting periodic covert operations, particularly along the kind of two choke points where the Highland Massif descends to the plains in the Golden Triangle of Southeast Asia and the Golden Crescent of Southwest Asia. And in this rugged, remote terrain, the CIA found that the only possible allies, the tribal warlords who could mobilize mercenary armies to fight communists in these remote mountains, also controlled the major commodity in both Afghanistan and in Highland Burma, opium. And so through their alliance with the CIA, these ethnic warlords became very quickly Highland drug lords. And they used the CIA's logistics, political protection, arms and supplies to build armies that expanded the production and processing and export of opium and heroin from these regions.
You're very matter-of-fact about this. It sounds as though it was a completely practical decision, but I think most Americans find it astonishing that an agency of our government could do that without considering the ethical consequences of it. Or did they simply decide that the practical matter was more important than the ethical matter?
I think at the start of this, the first of these covert operations, which started in 1950 in Highland Burma, only 2 years after the CIA was established, was a kind of bureaucratic accident. They sent out agents whose job it was to transform a ragtag remnants of the Nationalist Chinese Army into an effective force that could invade and liberate southwestern China from communist rule. That's a monumental task, and faced with this task of mobilizing militia forces half a world away from home all alone with just a few airplanes flying and guns and cash, that's a tall order, and I don't think Langley really asked too many questions about how this happened as long as it happened. Later on, by the time we got to the 1980s and early 1990s, when this had already happened in Burma and then in Laos, and in Laos with devastating consequences as a result of the CIA tacit complicity with the Laotian drug lords, Laos opened the world's largest heroin laboratory, and the commander-in-chief of the Royal Laotian Army owned that lab. They shipped that powdery number 4 heroin to South Vietnam, where by 1971, 34%, one-third of all U.S. combat forces fighting in South Vietnam were, according to a White House survey, heroin addicts. So this was fairly widely known by the 70s. So in the 80s, when the two large covert operations that got involved in drugs got going, one in Central America to stop the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, and the other, same year, 1979, in Southwest Asia, the Golden Crescent, to stop the Soviet-sponsored government in Afghanistan. When these operations got going, they both got very quickly, very heavily entangled in drugs. And from field operative all the way to director of Central Intelligence, they were aware that both operations were intermingled with the drug traffic, and they were quite willing to tolerate it.
This was, again, though, a practical matter. It was always a balance. We know this is not what the American people really want, but they don't understand the needs of this. The practical matter is we need to cooperate with the drug lords if we are going to achieve these more important political aims.
Exactly. The United States spent, from 1979 to 1992, somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 to $3 billion to sponsor, to fund a massive Islamic revolution by the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. And as the Mujahideen took over territory in Afghanistan, they imposed an opium tax upon the peasantry. That's how they funded their operation, which cost far more than the $2 to $3 billion we were expending on the operation. Our leading ally at that time, who's now, by the way, the target of CIA predator drones trying to kill him, was a man named Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. He ran a whole complex of heroin laboratories. He received about half of the $2 to $3 billion. He was our chosen warlord, and he was a very active drug lord. Moreover, Pakistan Inter-Service Intelligence, which was the CIA's counterpart agency in the region, was very heavily involved in the traffic, and there were vast narco profits that were made. And this was understood at the time that this was going on and this was necessary to the operation. In the 1990s, the former head of the CIA Afghan operation, a man named Charles Cogan, gave an on-camera interview. And he said, basically, there was fallout in terms of drugs. Yes, we knew that. But let's not lose our eye on the main objective here. The Soviets left Afghanistan. And the way he put those words together, I think, says it all. I mean, he knew it at the time. He knew there were consequences, and they were acceptable.
One of the things that astonishes me about all of this is that during this entire time, we have had periodic wars on drugs. The Nixon administration had a very, we thought, effective war on drugs. The Clinton administration talked a good game about a war on drugs. And you're saying in both cases, while that was going on, the CIA was giving lip service to the war on drugs, but also privately funding it?
In the era of the Cold War, we had two wars going, two wars against invisible enemies, one against communism and the other against drugs. And the war against communism started in 1948, and the drug war started in 1970. We're now in sort of phase five of the drug war. And in every instance, the Cold War trumped the drug war. And whenever there was a choice between keeping a DEA agent on station, a Drug Enforcement Administration agent on station who would be reporting negatively about the trafficking by CIA assets or allies, in every case, the CIA operation was given priority, the DEA operation was tamped down. Every time the CIA went into an area like Afghanistan or Honduras in Central America, where they ran a covert operation, the net result of a CIA operation was to create an enforcement-free zone where local authorities wouldn't operate against the traffickers who were allied with us, and U.S. authorities, particularly DEA, would stay out of the area.
So we had a war on drugs except where we didn't want anyone to look.
Right, and what you'll see is, as a consequence, that one of the kind of fallouts of these covert wars is that in the aftermath, the regions and sometimes whole nations are transformed from enforcement-free zones into major centers of the traffic. I'll give you one example. When we went into Afghanistan in 1979, the annual harvest was about 100 to 200 tons. By the time the CIA secret war was over, it had gone up tenfold from 100 to 200 tons to 2,000 tons. Okay? Yeah. By 1999, at the end of the civil war that followed the CIA secret war, Afghanistan's production was up to over 4,000 tons. And it was providing 75% of the world's illicit heroin supply.
But what you're saying is the CIA's response to that would be to say, yes, that may be true. In fact, it is true. But look, we got the Soviets out of Afghanistan.
Well, let's take the more recent example. Let's take our great victory in Afghanistan. The Bush administration decided instead of putting boots on the ground, U.S. conventional forces going in there, they would run the Afghan operation in 2001, just like they ran the secret war in Afghanistan from 1979 to 1992. So they brought all these old CIA operatives out of retirement or from posts where they've been transferred out of there. They gave them $70 million in $100 bills, bundles of them. They put them on helicopters and they flew them into the warlord areas, particularly the Northern Alliance area. And they revived all of the drug lords that had been pushed out of the country by the Taliban. Okay, in the year 2000, the Taliban decided to ban opium and heroin production. They were producing about 4,600 tons. Being an incredibly repressive regime, their ban was very effective in all the areas they controlled. And Afghanistan's opium production by 2001, by June, July 2001, just a few months before 9/11 and the start of our war there, had dropped from 4,600 tons. It had crashed downward to 180 tons, okay, by all statistics, UN and US. Okay, so we go in there with our $70 million. The warlords break open their arsenals. They hire their troops. They sweep in. They take Kabul. They sweep across the countryside. There's a political vacuum. And these warlords, come drug lords, then take over the countryside. Within 1 year, Afghanistan's opium production had gone from 180 tons to 3,400 tons. And it's climbing. And Afghanistan is now the world's first opium monocrop.
Alfred McCoy is the author of the book called The Politics of Heroin, CIA Complicity in the Global Drug Trade. He's an historian at the University of Wisconsin in Madison.